So here, this is our ongoing reading of Simondon's Individuation, Volume 2, the sort of mini book, History of the Notion of the Individual. We finished the part on Lucretius, if I remember correctly, last time, and we went through a couple of shorter sections on some of these other figures that are maybe secondary, I would say, and that are maybe less significant. And then we also looked at Plotinus, and he's going to be important for a couple of the philosophers that we're going to look at for today's reading. So Plotinus is a Neoplatonist. So he considers himself to be an expounder of Plato's doctrine. Of course, there's a big difference in form between Plato's dialogues, which are often aporetic. So they end in a sort of impasse where the participants realize that they don't know what justice is or what knowledge is, or that all the different definitions that they try to propose turn out not to work, and the dialogue just ends with this problem. Whereas for Plotinus, he wants to set out these systematic essays expounding what he takes to be Plato's doctrine. And so there's a sort of effort of systematization and unification of what is not necessarily unified in Plato's thought or Plato's writings themselves. And so one of the, or probably the core principle that Plotinus works from is this notion of the one, which is drawn from Plato's Republic. The one or the good, these are synonymous terms for Plotinus. So the one is above the realm of essences. So there's this realm of essences or ideas, the forms of entities, and the one is above that realm. So it doesn't have any form or any essence of its own. And so because of this, it means that we can't grasp the one through something like rational thought or intellect. The only contact we can have with the one is through this sort of ecstasy or this unification, where we actually lose our individuality in the face of the one. We just become united with the one. And Porphyry, who was one of Plotinus' students and who wrote his biography, says that Plotinus achieved this state 4 times in his life. So this is a rare state, even for someone who dedicates their whole life to contemplation of the one. The one is also the source of everything, in the sense that everything emanates from the one. The one, because it is goodness and has a sort of superfluity of being, so it's not impoverished in its being. It overflows itself and passes over into something less perfect or less ontologically primary. So it passes over into the realm of intellect, which is the next level of this emanation process. And then at the level of intellect is where the ideas sort of live. So the intellect has the capacity to grasp ideas of things. Then there's a whole series of levels of this emanation process where I believe the soul is the next level. It descends this hierarchy all the way down to matter, which is the lowest level just above the nothingness. There's this dynamic nature to this this emanation process that Simondon emphasizes, in the sense that the soul, the human soul, is capable of either ascending or descending this hierarchy. The soul can rise up to the level of intellect, and it can also sort of be captured by matter and the physical world and descend to the level of matter. This is one of the key ethical doctrines or ethical doctrines of the of Plotinus, is that there's this ability to, or this capacity that the soul has to ascend or descend in the hierarchy of being. And we'll see like what the development of that idea is in later Neoplatonists today. And then maybe one thing just before we start is that there's, as we'll see when we start reading today, is that there's an interaction, a very complicated interaction that we don't really know very well because of a lack of sources between the philosophical schools of late antiquity and various religious traditions and magic. And so these are all sort of interacting and influencing each other in complicated ways. And it's hard to sort of separate out the various strands, but that's a start trying to look at today. Yeah, so Angus, if you go ahead and read a section.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, popular beliefs. Philosophical thought is not the only one to contribute a certain theory of the individuality of beings and their mutual relations. Starting in the 2nd century, popular beliefs open up a large space for magic. Yet, magical practices suppose a universal sympathy of beings that exerts itself at immense distances, without any mechanical causality and by way of an influence that comes from the unity of beings. The imperial endeavors to create a solar religion take inspiration from the religion of Mithras. However, this religion shows the shining sun continually causing along its rays a certain descent of fire particles into the body, which it summons to life. Oh, hey, Ollie.
Hi, hello.
Hey. Then when death has dissolved the elements of which the individual is composed, the sun raises them up to it, according to Cumont, astrology and religion among the Greeks and Romans. Such a possibility of procession and conversion supposes that influences are exerted between beings with a common origin. Apuleius reveals the transformation of beings and the mysteries of the great goddess in the 8th book of the Metamorphoses. The acts of the cult become magical rites. The world becomes a vast network of magical influences. In his Alexander the False Prophet, Lucian shows how charlatanism took hold of the public. The magical rituals of the East are eagerly sought by readers of Philostratus' novel, Life of Apollonius of Tyana. Divination and magic are given free rein despite the prohibitions decreed by emperors. Chaldean oracles are utilized by theurgists, and this results in the creation of an art of making divine influence act where and when one wills. Alchemy also expands during this time. Iamblichus and Porphyry. A fully practical and anti-speculative thought begins to spread. The treatise on the mysteries of the Egyptians introduces purification as a unique means of knowledge. This treatise is perhaps the work of Iamblichus. In philosophers as well as theurgists and alchemists, the belief in a universal sympathy of beings is omnipresent. Porphyry consecrates a treatise on images to the rules for the construction of statues. Statues are, in fact, analogous to beings, whether men or gods. And through statues, one acts on beings due to this link of analogy of participation through influence. The statue is not an individual by itself, but a sort of devil of the being that it represents. Astrology is one of the aspects of this search for participation, as Porphyry's introduction to Ptolemy's Tetrabiblos shows. Iamblichus was both philosopher and mystagogue. Proclus abandons the theory according to which after Plotinus, the superior part of the soul is us without being us. It is us when we reach the superior. It stops being us when we descend to an inferior level. Iamblichus separates the daimon and the self. The dynamism of procession and conversion in Plotinus is replaced with a static conception that indefinitely multiplies the principles and gives a fixed place to the gods, heroes, and daimons. A hierarchy of ternaries replaces the Plotinian triad. The relation of the one to that which proceeds from it and then converts is replaced by the static arrangement of 3 distinct terms, the first of which performs the function of remaining, homenon, the second of which performs the function of proceeding, and the last of which performs the function of converting, to epistrophon. This distinction stabilizes the movement inherent to Plotinian metaphysics, but it thereby makes it difficult to resolve the problem of individuality. For absolute individuality will be neither in the first term nor in the other terms. With Plotinus, on the contrary, procession was directly a manifestation of the one, thus producing its kind through a superabundance of being. the complementary aspect of procession and of this recurrence of genesis is that that is, conversion closed a cycle of being that made relation into an expression of the absolute individual. Being and relation are grasped in a single way in the double movement that connects the first three hypostases. Similarly, the distinction within the human being between soul, the soul and the self makes reflection possible, which is the conjunction of two movements of procession and conversion in the establishment of a sort of reciprocity between these two movements. This recurrence linked to a schema of productive circularity disappears in the amplicus, and the doctrine of Plotinus is no longer included. This connection of magic with action at a distance, I think, is really interesting. Seems like it's closer, it seems, to Stoic physics than to Epicurean physics. So in Stoic physics, there's this possibility of a kind of action that isn't, I guess, an action at a distance, maybe, because of the way that everything is sort of suffused with the milieu. Whereas it seems like the Epicureans replace the milieu with a kind of void, which makes action at a distance impossible.
Yeah, I think that's right. So in Epicurean physics, the only kind of action that's accepted is mechanical action. So the impacts of one body on another, and ultimately those bodies are composed of atoms. So one atom impacts another, and you know, those atoms impact further atoms, and that's like the only sort of schema of action that's accepted in Epicurean physics. And so the idea of action at a distance is sort of banned from Epicurean physics. And here, yeah, so this notion of magical action through analogy, I think, is interesting when we think about how Simondon describes transductive thought as what is valid in analogical thinking. Analogical thinking is one where is a kind of thinking where we connect two different domains of thought at a distance from each other. We have to sort of create a realm of connection between these two distant realms of thought. And this is like transductive thinking allows us to do this in a way that's sort of rationally controlled and not just sort of arbitrary connections between different realms of thought. Magic is also in the other book, On the Mode of Existence of Technical Objects. Magic is what Simondon takes to be the sort of originary mode of relation of human beings to the world. And it's out of magic that science and religion first split off, and then those split off into further different forms of existence. But magic is the originary or the most fundamental relationship of human being to the world. So this sort of intrication of magic and philosophy is, even though Simondon doesn't dedicate a lot of time to it, I think it's probably pretty important for understanding Simondon's work as a whole.
I'm sorry, it's kind of been a long time. So could you tell which page is that?
Yes. So we just read onto page 515.
Okay, thank you. 515.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Sorry.
Okay. So let's go on to.
I forgot to mute. So I said that on.
Oh, sorry. What was that?
Oh, sorry. I muted myself on Discord on my. Sorry. Oh, okay. I muted myself.
Yeah. Now you're on mute. Okay. All right, so I'll read the next bit. Proclus. This abandonment becomes definitive by virtue of the same presuppositions in the system of Proclus, expressed in his theorem on transcendence in his Elements of Theology. A term equally present in all the terms of a series can only clarify all of them if it is neither in one of them nor in all of them, but before them all. Whether or not it is in all and divided among all, there must be a term that unites the parts of the series. Or instead it is in one of them alone, but then it will not be present in all of them. Consequently, concerning each series of things that possesses a common characteristic, there will be three terms: the unparticipated term, the participated term, and participating things. Relation becomes a term instead of being movement and operation. The recurrent circularity of Platonian procession and conversion is fully forgotten. The participated term, which in logic plays the role of joining the unparticipated term, comprehension of the concept, in the participating terms, extension of the concept, replaces the recurrent relation of procession and conversion, the movement from the one to the multiple and from the multiple to the one. With Proclus, the series becomes genus and the genus is cause. The density and consistency of the individual is lost, along with the circularity of procession and conversion of which it is the beginning and end. Each series is like a diakosmos, an oblique world, a transversal structure within which each series contains all possible realities in its own way. There is a law of development or distribution of reality that is shared by all series. Beings divide like unities, living beings like beings, intelligences like living beings, souls like intelligence. The one is then endowed with quite various powers relative to singular individuality. It turns them into achieved beings, tedesi urge. It keeps the parts together with their essence, suneke. It protects their limit from the encroachment of other essence, prude. Each series contains within it, from its own perspective, the characteristics of all the other series. Each reality remains in its place, in a fixed hierarchy. The metaphysical voyage of the soul is no longer possible. The mobile and spiritual self that is displaced at all levels becomes matter, and the one no longer exists. The absolute individual no longer creates. Nothing proceeds from it. Proclus critiques the Christians wholeheartedly. In the same way, he could also critique Plotinus, who asserts procession starting from the one. Quote, in what intention, after a laziness of infinite duration, will God manage to create? Because he thinks that this is best, and yet either he ignored it or he knew it. To say that he ignored it is absurd, and if he knew it, why did he not start before? St. Augustine responded to this accusation of absurdity by referring to a principle that is not very different from that of the superabundance of being, Damasius. Damasius, on the contrary, tries to recover some of the dynamism of the one in Plotinus by supposing the existence of the ineffable. The ineffable possesses both the characteristics of the individual and those of the non-individualized element. Spiritual life traverses the metaphysical world that Proclus described as static reality. The definitive functions of the unification of the real that Proclus imparted onto the one do not suffice as first principle. The absolute principle is beyond unity and plurality. It is necessary to suppose the existence of the ineffable, which is inaccessible to all, without coordination, separate to the point that it is no longer veritably possesses separation. This principle is without order and without hierarchy. What each singular being contains of the ineffable and the impenetrable comes from this ineffable. The higher we rise, the more we find the ineffable. Quote, the one is more ineffable than being, being more ineffable than life, life more ineffable than an intelligence. Unquote. Nevertheless, this ineffable reality is not hierarchically superior to what is ineffable in each of the singular beings, in the sense that the relation between the ineffable and singular beings would be hierarchical. It must be said that the ineffable communicates nothing of it to the realities that come from it. The ineffable is absolute initiative, but not hierarchical order. The ineffable cannot be defined. It can only be designated by a thought that affirms then denies the propositions that concern it, like what Plato does in the first hypothesis of the Parmenides. Procession and conversion, the monad and the dyad, the limited and the unlimited, the father and the dunamis only appear in realities derived from that for which we want to account through the union of two distinct principles. The ternary in Damasius is therefore replaced by three terms whose triplicity does not alter unity. The first is one all, one by itself and all insofar as it produces the second. The second is all one, all by itself and one insofar as it is produced by the first. Finally, the third is one insofar as it is linked to the first and all insofar as it is linked to the second. Each of the terms is like one aspect and one facet of the same reality. There is thus a certain circular relation in the primordial ternary. For Damasius, procession and conversion can only be said of intellectual natures and cannot help to explain all reality. Such is the meaning of the critique Damasius brings to bear against Proclus's commentary on Parmenides. Yeah, I think that's right. So Angus has said in the chat that there seems to be an opposition between dynamic theories of the one, like in Plotinus and Damasius, and static theories, like in Porphyry and Proclus. So yeah, this is stuff that I only know secondhand. I haven't read any of these authors. So I can't really comment on how accurate this interpretation is, but in the way that Simondon is depicting these authors here, yes, we have in Plotinus, we have this dynamic account of the one and of the soul's relation to the one. So the one has this procession that everything sort of emanates from the one, and then the soul can rise towards the one or can descend away from the one. What we find instead in Porphyry and Proclus is a sort of hierarchical account of these different levels of reality, as opposed to a dynamic account of the soul ascending and descending in reality. So we have different levels of gods and heroes and daimon. So that there's this hierarchy of different beings at different levels of reality, rather than a dynamics that allows the soul to ascend and descend in reality. Then we have in Demasius a sort of restoration or return to a more dynamic account of the relationship between the soul and the one, with this notion of the ineffable. So there's the one is something that can't be grasped through thought, and we can only sort of gesture towards the one by asserting and then denying the same propositions of the one. So we have a more dynamic account in which we still have this procession from the one or from the ineffable into this set of layers of reality. And then we also have apparently this conversion that we found in Plotinus, this relationship of the soul to the one and to matter as these sort of opposed pairs towards which the soul can be oriented.
I think this continuity that he draws here is really interesting. It seems like the way that Porphyry and Proclus see this static hierarchy of beings is sort of like the Stoic idea of enlightenment, in the sense that it's like all or nothing. There is no gradual improvement, like improvement in wisdom or ethical improvement. Like you either are a sage all at once or you aren't. And then I think later on, he's going to link this also to like predestination in Jansenism versus earlier Christian conceptions of moral development that are more continuous and therefore more like Plotinus.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit complicated because we have in Plotinus this notion of the ascent and descent of the soul, and so like the notion of something like a gradual progress, but we also have this notion of the unity with the one, this ecstasy that that he achieves four times in his life. This notion of unity with the one or unification with the one is something that is all or nothing. You either realize this state or this state is either realized in you or it isn't. There's no sort of gradual process of unification with the one. So we have sort of both elements are present in Plotinus at the same time. And then we'll see as we get to the Christianity section that both these elements appear in Christianity in various denominations or the different heresies that appear. So we have this notion of like a gradual moral perfection and the moral value of effort of, you know, trying to be better and trying to improve yourself. On the one hand, and then we also have this notion of grace, where we sort of receive salvation passively. It's not something that we do or that we earn through our activity. So what relation exactly these two aspects of Christianity have to each other is something that has been the source of different schisms and debates within Christianity, like since the beginning, and you know, is still something that distinguishes different denominations from each other. Maybe I'll also mention this bit about Proclus's critique of Christianity. There's a footnote, or I guess an endnote in the translation, which points to the way that this critique of Christianity. So I think the translation here makes it a little bit harder to follow what the argument is, but essentially, Proclus argues that in the Christian doctrine, you have God creates the world at a certain time. There's a beginning of the world. And then the question is, what was happening before this time, before the creation of the world? And in the Christian doctrine, God's creation of the world is God creates the world because creating the world is good, or the world that is created is good. Proclus asks the question, if creating the world was good, then why didn't God create the world earlier? Why did he pick this specific moment to do it? And then there's a sort of a dichotomy or a dilemma. So either God didn't create the world earlier because he didn't know it was good, which is absurd. It means God was ignorant. Or he did know that creating the world was good, and then it's impossible to understand why he didn't create it before. So Simondon in the footnote to this section here connects this with Spinoza's criticism of creation. So Spinoza likewise argues that there can't be anything like a creation of the world because God is eternal. So there'd be no way, there can't be something like a beginning in time of God's action, for God to decide to create the world at a certain moment. Instead, we have an infinite chain of becoming, of entities, of causes. So one thing is the cause of another, and the cause is itself the effect of a prior cause, and that chain goes on infinitely into the past. So there's no beginning of the world. So I think, yeah, we have a similar sort of notion of a world without beginning, and a criticism of a doctrine of creation of the world. Okay, so let's go on to the section on Christianity.
I can read it before that. I have a question about the idea of a proskuneus. So what proskuneus, is that the right pronunciation? So the, as far as I understand, it's like if we can visualize, and then that also if we connect that idea to, as you said, Spinoza, it's like an extension of the God's words. Like as far as I understand in ethics, like the God, I mean the has to do with extensiveness. Like so in terms of like death and the breadth and then the heights and in every way, like the so called the God's words is extended. In that sense, like what Proclus thinks is that this continuity, like which includes the previous parts attributes, I don't think that's kind of like a linear continuity, and it should not be like a circular shape either, because it should not be like a repetition. So maybe like it could be like some kind of spirally, like a spiral shape, because like it contains the previous kind of like features, but at the same time it also extends and also it continues. So if we satisfy these all conditions, it could be some kind of a circular shape.
I'm not that familiar with Proclus's sort of cosmology, so I'm not sure whether he has in mind something like a circular causality or a circular relation. We saw with the Stoics, for example, in previous weeks, the Stoics had this notion of the great year, this circle where all the elements are sort of separated out from fire, and there's a sort of cosmic era where you have these distinct elements, and then after however many thousands or whatever of years, the elements all return into fire, and then the cycle begins again. So this notion of a circular or cyclical time is something that was sort of available to Greek thought or Hellenistic thought. So I'm not sure if Proclus, he may have had that kind of picture in mind of a circular causality, or he may have had also some notion of just an infinite chain, a world without a beginning or an end, where just every event is preceded by another one and followed by a second one. So I'm not sure which one he actually had in mind. It could have been either of those pictures.
Okay. Thank you. And then maybe I can bring this issue like later, maybe next time, like by reading more about the idea.
Yeah, that would be helpful if you want to look into what Proclus's cosmology was, what his picture of the order of time and the nature of the beginning or end of time and the world. I think that would.
Okay. Christianity. Brahe posits that there is no Christian philosophy. We will not allow ourselves to contradict the historian of philosophy concerning a point we have followed throughout the whole course of this explication. However, the existence of Christianity was able to play a role in the genesis of philosophical thoughts. And if there is no Christian philosophy, properly speaking, there is a meaning of Christian ethics that imposes a certain conception of the human individual. It is not as a ritual, or even properly speaking as a religion, defining a certain conception of the sacred, that Christianity was able to contribute something to thought. Its cut is not essentially distinguished from the various theologies that blossomed in this era. Its theology is not unrelated to the metaphysical conceptions of Plato, Proclus, Damascus. Furthermore, it borrows significantly from the Old Testament. Christianity is also an ethics. It is even profoundly an ethics. Yet, instead of giving positive rules, instead of defining the pure and the impure, good and evil, in long lists, as Hesiod provides, for example, for the Greeks, or as the author Leviticus provides in the written tradition of Hebrews. This ethics provides nothing but a negative canonical. Do not do unto others what you would not have them to do unto you. Or whoever among you without sin may cast the first stone. Or no light, you care, judge not. It is quite remarkable that almost all the commandments of the church have a positive form, whereas the precepts that constitute the canonical of the good news are negative, if not in their grammatical turn of phrase, then at least in their veritable signification. Yet the negative form of a canon defines a veritable universality of the action it defines, and it considers the individual as a free subject. A possible rule is never fully transposable. It is circumstantial and consequently supposes that the being to which it is addressed is in a certain milieu with this or that social relation. Conversely, a negative canonical is really universal, always transposable, but it supposes that the individual can be thought and think itself as a reality independent of circumstances in which it is found. These circumstances conceived in the relation to a negative canonical become universal. Due to its negative form, Christianity becomes an ethics of the absolute individual. Every rule that seems positive in it are negative rules in the end. Continue?
Yes, let's continue.
Thanks. Okay, St. Paul. Because of this fact, Christianity is cosmopolitanism. Consider St. Paul. There is no longer Jew or Greek. There is no longer slave or free. There is no longer male and female. For all of you are one in Christ Jesus. As with Seneca, there is an indifference relative to the social condition in which one lives. The only one who can know the truth is one who is totally free from all circumstances and who has become a spiritual man, pneumatic, in opposition to one who is merely psychical, remains engaged in matter. Like Epictetus, St. Paul wants to save men, and what is important to him is the salvation of individual being. The idea that an individual is neighbor with respect to another exists in Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius, as well as in St. Paul. The fraternity of men is even more pronounced in Stoicism by way of the belief in the mission of Hercules, son of Jesus, who spreads justice and virtue throughout the world, and by way of the idea of Christ, who is the Son of God made man, offering himself as a victim for the salvation of men. This ethics is indeed an ethics of universality that considers humanity as a set of individuals who, as men, all have an identical nature. Yet, this canonical persisted in Christianity even when it evolved, even when it invested its forces into this or that social or communitarian temporal cause. Here, we must distinguish between the church, community among communities, or Christianity, which lived on undue to taxes and often was taught explicitly in the church. At the same time, as an implicit content was taught, as was not always universal ethics, and was quite rarely so in the century. It is of these ethical teaching that one can say that it contains philosophical thoughts precisely relative to individuality. It may be that this ethics is not proper to Christianity, but it has been conveyed by Christianity, thereby providing an incitement to think that was given for many centuries to many peoples. After having brought Epictetus and St. Paul closer together, Ibrahim declares that there is nevertheless one difference that produces the fundamental feature of Christianity. Absent in Epictetus, who, as Pascal says, do not know the misery of man and who makes man into his own savior. In St. Paul, the sinner who knows the good cannot do this because of the power of sin, who is counterbalanced only by Christ. Unlike in Stoicism and even Philonism, it's no longer a question these semi-abstract powers that assist men, divine logos or interior daemon, but a question of historical personage whose death has saved humanity through an action of completely mysterious effect, which is completely different from that of the pagan sage who simply teaches or offers himself as a model. This difference, in fact, is quite important, but it is not the only one and is no more essential than the others in itself. It signifies that the Christian individual is never an abstract being to such an extent that redemption itself can only be made possible by way of mediation that is a complete incarnation of God, i.e., an individualization of God in space and time. In Stoicism, as well as in Christianity, the individual is a citizen of the world, but it's the Stoic word in the world that we see this universalization can only take place due to a certain abstraction based on the social condition, based on the creation of a persona. Conversely, the transcendent aspect of the world within which the inter-individual relation of grace arises allows the whole concrete character of the individual being to survive. In Christianity, the concrete individual is the object of human effort, not the support of the role of a role. Transcendence unmoves the individual from this world, but can conserve him in the concrete state. Immanence connects him to the world, of it by effectuating the separation of it is rather there was a certain mixture of Stoicism or cynicism and Christianity. After the intervention of the monasticism, the practices of maceration.
Yeah, the difference is here, Ali. Yeah, thanks. Let's stop here.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. What? How can you read that one? Da 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 da.
Yeah, the separation of ta ephemin and ta uk ephemin. These are terms for in Stoicism. What concerns me and what does not concern me. I think is the translation. In Stoicism, there was this doctrine that you should sort of focus your energy and attention to your own thoughts and your own situation and what you can control, whereas everything that has to do with your social status and what other people think about you and so on is outside of your control, and you should not concern yourself with that. So that's something that is outside your sort of domain of interest. What Simondon is alluding to there. So let's go back a little bit to the beginning of this Christianity section. There's this notion that Breillet has, that there's no such thing as a Christian philosophy, properly speaking, which is a bit of a strange statement, because we can think of people like Augustine, and some of the church fathers are certainly informed by philosophy, and like even a lot of the texts of the pre-Socratic philosophers that we have now are like citations from church fathers that we, those are the only fragments of those philosophers that we have left to us now. I think the idea is that Christianity sort of is opposed to the idea of salvation through knowledge, through or understanding of the human condition or something like that, which is characteristic of Hellenistic philosophy. So in Hellenistic philosophy and in all the different schools, there's this idea that the sage is capable of achieving salvation or achieving the good life by understanding the world or understanding the nature of the soul or having knowledge of some kind. Whereas in Christianity, salvation doesn't come through anything like knowledge, but through faith. So there's this fundamental opposition between the philosophical approach to salvation and the religious approach to salvation. But Simondon argues here that even if Christianity doesn't, properly speaking, have a philosophy, there's still an influence of Christianity on thought, on philosophy, through its ethics. So there's a few different aspects of Christian ethics that that have influence on the notion of the individual and the philosophical thought of the individual. So one aspect that he points to here is the way that in Christianity we have a set of negative ethics as opposed to positive ethics. So a positive ethics would be one that tells people, you know, you should do X or you have to do Y. Whereas a negative ethics is one that just says you shouldn't do X or you shouldn't do Y. And what Simondon argues here is that a positive ethics is tied to a particular social context in the sense that telling people to do a certain thing implies that they live in circumstances where doing that thing is actually possible. And so an example of this is in Judaism, there are certain commandments that have to do with the rituals of the temple, contemporary rabbis say are no longer possible to fulfill. So it's not possible to fulfill those commandments because the temple no longer exists. And so these commandments presuppose a certain context in which the temple exists, whereas some ethical principle, a negative ethical principle that says, whoever is without sin may cast the first stone, something like that, like this. So this principle is essentially saying that we shouldn't judge others for the sins they may have committed because we ourselves have committed sins. So this is a sort of negative principle, and it because it doesn't because it's a negative principle, it doesn't presuppose a particular social context in which we can perform a certain action. It sort of transcends any particular social context. So this is what Simondon takes to be sort of significant about Christianity, is that it introduces these negative rules or negative ethics that allows for the individual to be valued or to be sort of thought of outside of any particular social context. So the individual is valuable or has ontological validity outside of a particular social arrangement. The individual as such is important. And then in the section on St. Paul, Simondon here compares St. Paul to the Stoics in certain respects. So there's a similar notion of cosmopolitanism. And so St. Paul was, of course, a Jew, but he was a Roman citizen. And he wrote in Greek, so he belongs to different worlds, he's one of the first, or possibly the first, in the Christian tradition to make Christianity something that goes beyond the Jewish community. So whereas previously it was a specifically Jewish or sort of post-Jewish school or religious tradition, St. Paul is the first one to present to start preaching Christianity to non-Jews, and who argues that this distinction between Jews and Gentiles is no longer valid or is no longer important in Christianity. And so he has a similar notion. So the Stoics have this notion of cosmopolitanism, this idea that we should consider ourselves as belonging to humanity first and only secondarily to a particular city or a particular state. And so our real home or our real belonging is the universe as a whole and not Athens or Rome or whatever. And then there's also the notion of what is sort of distinct in Christianity and in St. Paul in particular, in opposition to previous philosophical systems, is the notion that the human individual is not capable of achieving salvation through through its own efforts. So you can't just sort of through ethical practice or through gaining knowledge or achieving wisdom or whatever, you can't just reach salvation just through your own efforts. There is this external factor which is known as grace in the Christian tradition. So there has to be this grace granted to the individual to allow for salvation. And this is also tied up with the notion of Christ as a historical individual. So there was a particular, you know, person who sacrificed himself for us, and this historical person, this event of the crucifixion and so on, is a requirement for human salvation, and it's human salvation is not possible outside of this relation to this singular historical event.
I think this point about how for St. Paul, the sinner who knows the good can't do the good, is kind of an interesting inversion of the Socratic position, which, as I understand it, is that nobody does. I can't formulate this. But if you, for Socrates, I think if you know the good, you will always do the good. Whereas for Paul, there's something, you can know the good, and there's something else that intervenes that prevents you from doing it, which is sin. And this kind of seems like, it makes me think that there's something like a kind of incipient notion of an unconscious or something that determines and limits, you know, what you can know rationally or do sort of willingly on your own, something that distorts and determines action, conscious action from outside.
Yeah, I think this is tied up with the way that human effort is no longer considered to be sufficient for achieving salvation. So for Socrates, as you pointed out, there's this notion of knowledge of the good and good action as being sort of coextensive. So anyone who knows what the good is will do the good just by virtue of knowing it. And so there's a sort of transparency of the good, I guess you could say. So it's not something that there's nothing obscure about the good. And then for St. Paul and in Christianity in general, yeah, you're right. There's this notion of sin as something that is a sort of part of the human condition. So we're all sinners. And because of this, we can know the good without being able to do the good sort of through our own efforts. And it's only through grace that we are capable of achieving a life where we do the good, even when we know it. And so this notion of a sort of obscurity within the human soul, or this notion of sin as something that prevents us from doing the good even when we know it, is tied up with this notion of the human individual as not being able to achieve salvation through its own efforts. Okay, I'll read the next bit. I think we'll read the rest of St. Paul and then Augustine, and then we can end there for today. It is rather that there was a certain mixture of Stoicism or Cynicism and Christianity after the intervention of monasticism and the practices of maceration. This difference is revealed by the continuous nature of individual moral progress, which is opposed to the nature of the all or nothing of moral progress in the Stoics. Here again, we find in St. Paul a doctrine that was partially forgotten afterwards. out of the individual who is in constant progress or regression and who is never fixed in his destiny until the moment of his death, because he can always progress or regress with respect to God. Another theory followed this doctrine of moral progress, namely that of the distinction between those who have received grace and those who have not, a distinction which will end in the theory of predestination we find in the Jansen. There is indeed a doctrine of the individual in Christianity, and this doctrine is the seed of a philosophical thought. We are left to wonder what is first and absolutely fundamental in Christianity, the search for transcendence, or the search for the concrete and complete individual, all of whose acts matter and contribute to modifying his distance from God. This individual lives in a world that is not eternal and where knowledge does not suffice to eradicate. Man's activity is open in time and effectively creates the new. There is an initiative of man. Knowledge is not the only initiative of man. St. Paul, who borrows from the Gnostics the distinction between the hylic, the psychic, and the pneumatic, is on the contrary opposed to their doctrine according to which knowledge of the world is what drives out evil. He is opposed to their moral dualism. According to St. Paul, redemption comes from the efficacy of Christ's sacrifice and not from the knowledge he brought, as the Gnostics claimed. Christianity is a monism relative to the theory of gnosis. It affirms and maintains the unity of the individual being instead of allowing him to be considered a divine spark stuck in the mud. It is also a monism relative to Manichaean dualism, according to which duality between two sources of powers generates a duality in man, a duality Christianity does not accept. For Christianity, the duality is not actual but virtual. It results from sin and can cease through grace. The state of sin is not a simple juxtaposition. Only a redemption can modify this homogeneous state, not a simple splitting. It is therefore impossible to make decidedly two parts of man. The state that results from the successive acts of creation, then from the sins of the flesh, is a state that conserves the idea of the resurrection of the glorious body. So this is the point that we were discussing a little while ago about how there's these two opposed ideas in Christianity about the relationship between the soul and God as either this sort of indefinite progress and this sort of dynamic conception where the soul can approach God or move away from God at any points in life. So you can have a, you know, deathbed conversion. This was actually something that in early Christianity was quite popular, like converting on your deathbed, because the idea was that if you converted earlier and then you you sort of descend into sin again, then you would be damned. But then if you convert on your deathbed, you don't have time to continue to sin, so you you're sort of reaching salvation that way. So there's on the one hand this notion of the possibility of conversion and the possibility of redemption at any moment in life. And then on the other hand, we have this notion of grace as this all or nothing property that individuals either have or they don't have. And this brings about the idea of predestination. So the doctrine that God selects certain individuals for the purpose of saving them, and certain other individuals are damned. A selection of individuals before any actions on their part. So individuals are either chosen for salvation or they're doomed to damnation, and there's nothing that individuals can actually do to change those fates. So this is the doctrine of predestination. And so these two different doctrines of the relationship between the soul and God, or the nature of salvation, these two doctrines are sort of opposed in Christianity. They both have adherents within the Christian tradition, and different sort of schools split off and form around these doctrines. And then there's also here, Simondon mentions the opposition between Christianity and Gnosticism. So Gnosticism was a loose collection of different religious traditions, but they all have in common, or what they share is this notion of the world as being evil and the human soul as being something that is sort of trapped in the world, something that is not of the world, but is trapped in the world. The idea of salvation in the Gnostic tradition, or in various Gnostic traditions, is that we achieve salvation by sort of realizing that we are not part of the world, by having knowledge of our belonging to a higher realm, outside of the world, we achieve salvation. And so St. Paul and Christianity in general opposes this idea of Gnosticism. And so Christianity opposes the dualism of Gnosticism, this idea that there's these two distinct realms and the soul belongs to the higher realm outside the world. So Christianity is monistic in that sense. It holds that there's sort of one realm that the world is God's creation and not something evil in itself. There's also a sort of monism of Christianity in terms of the understanding of the human soul, in contrast to certain Gnostic doctrines that hold that there's a higher part of the soul and a lower part that are sort of in conflict with each other. But Christianity allows for something like what Simondon calls here a virtual duality. So the soul has two opposed capacities or two opposed potentials. So the soul can either turn towards God or turn away from God. But this doesn't mean that there's sort of two principles or two different components of the human soul that are opposed to each other. So Christianity has this notion of this virtual duality that allows for the soul to either turn towards God or turn away from God. But it opposes the doctrine of an actual duality that would be two distinct elements or components within the soul. So this is sort of highlighting the role of the individual in Christianity, that rather than sort of breaking up the individual into these different components, like in Gnosticism, the individual is treated as a unit, as something that has unity and continuity within it. Just looking at the time, I know, Angus, you wanted to end a little bit early, so maybe we can.
I was just going to say I'm probably going to have to jump.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll start from the St. Augustine part next time, there's a part on St. Augustine, and then Cassiodorus, and then there's Augustine, and then there's the part on the different heresies, and then he sort of skips ahead into medieval philosophy, and he gets to early medieval philosophy, and then from the 12th century onwards. He sort of speeds up the chronology a little bit as we get into the Christian era. Okay, so thanks for coming out, and I hope to see you next time.